From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
People from the very beginning of time have been wondering about such questions as, what's it all about? Why am I here? How do I make sense of this? So I think it's the big existential problem.
Today, we're going to take a stab at answering those questions, though not by way of religion, but rather through the latest insights from neuroscience, psychology, and the philosophy of mind. And we'll see why more and more non-believers are looking to science to explain spiritual experience. Also, best-selling writer Daniel Levitin on how the musical brain created human nature.
Maybe music has always been a form of naked, open, honest communication, something you couldn't fake. If you were singing a song and you weren't really feeling it, everybody around the cave and around the campfire would know.
But first, the remarkable story of Jill Bolte Taylor, a Harvard-trained brain scientist who suffered a devastating stroke and lived to tell the tale. In her memoir, My Stroke of Insight, Taylor recounts the crippling stroke that came out of nowhere, the unexpected euphoria it created, and then the long and arduous process of recovery. Anne Strainchamps asked Jill Bolte Taylor to describe what happened on December 10th, 1996.
On the morning of the stroke, I woke up, and the first thing I really realized was that I had this pulsing pain behind my left eye. And I just got up, and I realized that I was very sensitive, hypersensitive to light stimulation. So I closed the drapes and went into my exercise room, and I thought, you know, getting the blood dissipating through my brain would be a good thing. So I jumped onto my CardioGlider, and I was exercising on this thing, realizing that as I looked down at my hands, they looked like primitive claws grasping onto this bar.
How long did it take before you realized you were having a stroke?
Oh, it was probably 45 minutes to an hour.
Wow.
And it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed. And that, to me, was the warning sign of stroke. Everything else was just peculiar, weird neurological stuff that was interesting through the eyes of a brain scientist. You know, I'm trying to assess what's going on, what circuits are involved. Is this a migraine? Is this something else that I'd never experienced before? What was it?
Eventually, you began to lose the ability to speak. But were you still thinking in words inside your head that whole time?
It was interesting because, you know, we think in two ways. Our right hemisphere thinks in pictures and images and essentially running a videotape of our experience moment by moment. And the left hemisphere places language and words on our experience so that we're talking to ourselves. And I would have these intermittent waves of having absolutely no language whatsoever where my mind was absolutely silent and all I was doing was observing through the video, if you will. And then the language would come back online and I could reattach to the external world and my relationship to it. Because when I lost language, I lost my identity. I lost the part of my brain that says, my name is Jill Bolte Taylor. I am a neuroanatomist. This is where I live, etc. So as the language cut out, it also shut out my relationship to the external world.
Mm. So what happened when, for instance, you were able to dial 911 and people showed up and, you know, took you to the hospital? Were you able to talk then?
Well, actually, I was not able to dial 911 because the area in my brain that understood numbers was actually the location of where the blood vessel was that exploded. So I didn't have any numbers. I had no ability to even understand what a 911 was. But I did manage to call work, but I couldn't remember the number. So I found a business card of mine that had my phone number on it. And at that point, I could not distinguish what a number was, but I matched the shape of the squiggles on the business card to the shape of the squiggles on the phone pad. And then when my colleague answered the phone, fortunately, he was at his desk. When he spoke to me, it was roar, 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 roar. He sounded very garbled, and I couldn't understand his specifics. But I could tell by his intonation, I could recognize that he understood that it was me, because when I spoke to him, I could not speak. I went roar, 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 roar as well. So, but he recognized that it was me, and he did get me help.
Wow. What a terrifying experience. Did you, as the blood began to kind of spread in your brain, did you ever begin to feel that you were dying?
I did. On the morning of the stroke, after my colleague came and gave me help and took me to the first hospital, and the first hospital ran a CAT scan on my brain, and it showed this major hemorrhage in the left hemisphere. And at that point, I just really didn't have any energy left in my body, and I curled up into a little fetal ball. The best way for me to describe it is I felt my energy shift. I felt my whole body become lighter, I surrendered, if you will. And I knew that I was no longer the one choreographing my life, and either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was going to be the moment of my death. And I have to say that it was, you know, you hear about these stories about it's an extremely peaceful experience. Well, for me, it was a total experience of euphoria. The more detached I became from the external world, my relationship to it, my relationship to individuals, the lighter I felt in my body and the more euphoric I felt. So I essentially found a space of nirvana.
Was it a disappointment to begin to come back?
It wasn't a disappointment, but it was definitely a process. And for me, it was a decision because I did feel this incredible sense of euphoria. I lost the boundaries of my body, the cells in my brain that understood where I begin and where I end. So I felt that I was as big as the universe. At the same time, I was still alive. My body had been stabilized. I was given another opportunity to live life. And so it was a conscious choice for me. 1,000 times a day, am I willing in this moment to attend to the details that I do not understand and to endure that agony of recovery in order to try to make sense of the external world, which seemed to spiral at 1,000,000 miles an hour with chaos? So I don't think it was a disappointment because, you know, the amount of time that I'm going to have in this body is nil, hardly anything in comparison to time. So I can't say that it was disappointing, but I can tell you that when my time comes again, there will be no fear and there will be probably an elation and celebration.
There's so many remarkable things about your story. One of the most remarkable is that you're talking to us and fluently.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Why was the damage not permanent?
Well, you know, the damage does not have to be permanent. I was very fortunate in that the hemorrhage happened in my cerebral cortex, which is my ability to think. So I lost my mind. I lost my past. I lost my memories of my life prior to that. At the same time, memories are things that you can make new ones. And once the hemorrhage, 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, the physicians went in and removed this blood clot the size of a golf ball that was pushing on my brain cells, not allowing me to think. And once that was removed, I was capable of learning again. I essentially was an infant in a woman's body, but I had the potential to regain ability. I was very blessed that my mother came back into my world and took over. She recognized that I was now an infant again, and we started at the very beginning of, you know, what do you do with a baby? You rock her. And so she comes into my life, and she started rocking me. And we started again in our relationship, and language was my number one priority. I figured if my body never came back, okay, I could, you know, make amends for that. But if I didn't have language, then I really could not be as active a member of our society. So language was my number one priority for recovery.
You lost so much from the stroke. You know, you talked about losing language and losing logic and losing numbers and losing your memories. You gained a lot too, though. You know, when the left hemisphere shut down, you suddenly were able to access and come into all of the ways of perceiving that belong to the right hemisphere. Can you describe some of what that was like?
Yeah, it was really wonderful. You know, we have these two very different hemispheres inside of our heads, and they process information in totally different ways. And the right hemisphere thinks in pictures, and it is all about the present moment. It is analyzing and perceiving all the information from our sensory systems, creating a big, enormous collage of this present moment. And the existence of the present moment is beautiful. There's no judgment judgment there. It's just it is. And when I lost the judgment and the critical analysis ability of my left hemisphere, I lost the past. I lost the future. I was given the present moment. And the present moment, you know, when you laugh, when you feel joy, it happens right here, right now. It's a present moment experience. And when you feel calm and you feel peaceful, it's because you're out of the past, you're out of the future, and you're just experiencing, allowing your body to relax into the present moment. And for me, it was a total experience of peacefulness and euphoria.
You know, one of the things I think is so potentially exciting about what you've discovered is that up until now, the kind of experience you're describing as the right hemisphere experience has been the goal of various meditation and prayer practices. And, you know, many religions write about it, talk about it. But what's happened with you is that what has been up until now kind of a matter of faith and belief, you're able to demonstrate how it's, no, it's simple scientific fact. You know, instead of saying to us, your birthright is this experience of oneness with all that is, you know, and that being a matter of faith, you're saying, no, it's right there. It's in your right hemisphere. It's just part of your brain.
Yeah. Well, you know, and even coloring, you know, have you ever noticed that if you just sit down with a coloring book, and, you know, how many people in their 40s actually sit down with a coloring book, or go to art class, or go into a space and say, I have zero plans for the next hour. What am I going to do? I'm going to create something. And allowing yourself to just figure out in this moment, what am I going to do? There's an entire population of people who are writing to me saying, oh my gosh, you're validating my world. Thank you so much. They're giving their families their books and saying, this is why I'm the way I am. It's because I got a right hemisphere. You know, I have creativity. I have this experience of spontaneity and the willingness to be in the moment. And you know, our left hemisphere looks at these people and says, but you're not being productive. So there's incredible bias to the right hemisphere experience, because those individuals are, you know, they have their head in the clouds, or they're not always, you know, on time. That drives me nuts. They're never on time. And it's because they're not on time. They're not on your time. They're on their own time, having a great time doing what they're doing. So, you know, judgment, that critical judgment, not just of, yeah, I'm wasting my time here. Why am I sitting here doing this? I'm just wasting my time. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. The point is to allow yourself to get out of the fact that you think that you're wasting your time.
Jill Bolte Taylor, talking with Anne Strainchamps about her book, My Stroke of Insight. Taylor is a neuroanatomist at the Indiana University Medical School.
Can we have your name, sir?
Maston, Bob Maston.
The pranksters, Jim Coyle and Mal Sharp, with one of their Man on the Street interviews.
Bob, we can now get into the human brain. We can listen to what the brain is thinking even before the being who possesses the brain expresses that thought. Is it your feeling that this is going a little too far?
No, I think it's like any other discovery, fire, explosives, anything else.
Would you be interested yourself in finding out what your brain was thinking and listening to those thoughts?
Well, if it would accomplish something.
What essentially it boils down to is a recording device would be lowered into your brain after a surgical opening. It would be lowered into your brain, and it would record thoughts that are just being formulated at the time that the device was loaded into your brain. You would go along with this, wouldn't you?
What would be the purpose of it?
Well, a recording would be made.
Well, it would depend. What would be gained out of it?
It would...
Would it help somebody? Would it aid me?
It would...
Would it be an advantage to it?
Sure. Insofar as your personal benefit is concerned, you would have privy, you would have access to a thought that was being formulated in your brain that might never reach a conscious level. That's how you would gain. Others would gain in another way.
In other words, what you're doing, you're probing the subconscious to bring it out to attention of your conscious mind.
Right.
Right. And then we're going to put it on a phonograph record.
Well, now that would be interesting.
Would you be willing to go along with it? Would you be willing to contribute your thoughts?
Contribute?
We want to open your head up and make a recording, right?
That's what it boils down to.
Who's going to do it?
We're trying to make a buck, just like everybody else, let's face it.
We're going to turn out an LP, get it in stores. It'll be your thoughts. You won't make any money on it. Mm-hmm. It'll be your thoughts, and we'll make the money because we perform the operation if it comes out.
You would get to hear your own thoughts. That's what it would boil down to. All we're asking you to do is to accompany us to a room in this area. It's not an involved operation.
The fact that you aren't doctors in the first place, I would never let anyone operate or do anything to me that wasn't a medically approved.
This isn't medical. This is idiotic.
This isn't medical.
We got our background is mostly in carpentry. We use carpentry tools. We have a regular bit drill. We drill right into your head just like a 2x4.
I think that you should stick to drilling wood and not my head.
The absurd imposters Jim Coyle and Mal Sharp with their put-on microphone in brain.
There ain't no sin in Cincinnati.
Can science look inside the brain and unlock the secrets of spirituality? In a minute, we'll get one answer. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. George Valiant is a Harvard psychiatrist on a mission. He's out to change the way we talk about spirituality, to take it out of the realm of sacred scripture and religious dogma, and instead ground it in hard science, specifically neuroscience and cognitive psychology. He lays out his argument in his book Spiritual Evolution, A Scientific Defense of Faith. Valiant says people are innately spiritual. But as he told Steve Paulson, this insight has been lost on the medical profession, at least until very recently.
It's only within the last 20 years that psychiatry and psychology have rediscovered the positive emotions, which are just as important as hate, fear, and anxiety. And these emotions, when you start thinking about it, are the same thing that we mean with the term spirituality, and they arise in the same parts of the brain, namely the limbic system in contrast to the instinctual hypothalamus or the Homo sapiens neocortex.
Okay, so you just laid out a lot there. Let's unpack that a little bit. What positive emotions are you talking about?
Well, St. Paul gave us three with faith, hope, and love. Faith being parsed as trust rather than belief, which underlies dogma. But you can then add to those emotions gratitude, forgiveness, joy, awe, compassion, all of which are hardwired in mammals and in Homo sapiens.
So to some degree, you are distinguishing between spirituality and religion. I mean, you're saying...
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you're playing with words, you can do anything you want with them, but let me just try to separate them out as black and white. If you study twins, separated twins, and twins who are raised together, religion is entirely a function of culture. Unrelated sibs raised in the same family will have the same religion. Identical twins separated at birth will be concordant for either high levels of spirituality or low levels of spirituality. Second, that religions almost all require an intermediary between us and our higher power, where with spirituality, you don't need a mediator to feel spirituality in a cathedral or on a mountaintop. And the third is that religions tend to be left-brain, verbal, dogmatic, whereas spirituality is emotional. You don't need words. It's often hard to express spiritual experiences. And yet, if you think of golden retrievers, they are models of faith, hope, and love.
So you're kind of down on religion is what it sounds like. I mean, you're saying it's a matter of belief, of kind of buying into some belief system or maybe some set of doctrines.
Oh, I'm not down on religion, but I'm very much in favor of connectedness. I think we have to live as one planet and to discover ways in which we're more similar than dissimilar. And the second reason that I make this difference is in psychiatry and psychology, the positive emotions are thrown out with the Richard Dawkins bathwater. And so that if you take a 21st century classic American textbook of psychiatry, there are hundreds of lines on negative emotions, hate, terrorism, sin, guilt, and of course thousands of lines on depression and fear. And yet there's only 5 lines on hope, 1 on joy, and none on compassion, love, forgiveness, etc.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up the name Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist,
yes.
Who I'm sure would say that some of these positive emotions you've mentioned, love, joy, compassion, gratitude, are wonderful things. I don't think he would classify them as spiritual. He would say they're just part of what it means to be human. I guess I'm still sort of coming back to that question, you know, why do you want to use these as a way into our understanding of spirituality?
I mean, from idealistic or I suppose a religious sense, it's because the positive emotions are all about the other. They're pro-social, but they're also, I am not God. And the negative emotions and the sort of mechanistic Dawkins or Dennett or Sam Harris approach is that I can figure this all out for myself. And as soon as we start thinking it's all about me, we lose some of the pro-social, let me use the word magic, that there's something beyond myself, there is a higher power, which may just be Mother Nature, but at least one has a sense of reverence for it. And to bring this closer to home, Ralph Nader says cars kill 100,000 innocent people a year, automobiles are terrible. And Richard Dawkins says quite correctly that religions kill tens of thousands of people a year. Religion is terrible. And what Nader forgets is that to about 1 billion or 2 billion people, cars are quite handy. And what Dawkins ignores is to about 6 billion people, religion is a vehicle we have of pulling the very emotions up into consciousness that the psychiatrists and the psychologists ignore.
Let's talk about the brain here. You have said that spirituality is rooted in the limbic system, I guess what's been called the mammalian brain. Can you explain that?
Yeah. For the hundreds of millions of years that reptiles existed, the brain didn't expand. Evolution depended on size, teeth, thickness of skin. It was only with the evolution of mammals that evolution started to select for brain size. And the first dramatic difference between mammals and reptiles was that mammals developed the limbic system, which allows for selfless care of the young by the parents. It allows the separation cry, which conveys both attachment and the belief that if a mammal hollers, he or she is going to be brought back into the nest, where if a reptile makes too much noise, he ends up as his father's lunch. So that these basic mammalian traits evolved, and their importance can be brought home to the cortex, which is what the philosophers and the psychologists and generally rational people that take a dim view of spirituality and regard reason as the best thing that can possibly happen.
Reason, ideas, and science, all of that is rooted in the cortex.
It's rooted in the cortex. And yet, if you do the simple experiment of scraping off all of a mother hamster's cortex, she's real stupid in mazes, but she can raise her pups well. Whereas if you damage her limbic system only slightly, but leave the cortex intact, she can run mazes just fine, but she's a totally inadequate mother.
At one point in your book, you say the new science has liberated the positive emotions from the realm of mysticism and from religious dogma. Are you saying that we need to have a new understanding of spirituality that is rooted in science, that's not so dependent on traditional religious beliefs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, old Einstein, who was a pretty cool scientist, said the most important emotion for a scientist was awe, and to be without awe was to be a snuffed-out candle. And this, of course, is diametrically opposite from what Freud said, who felt that if you had awe, you were some kind of an infant.
I'm wondering if there's a larger quest for you that's going on, and that's to find scientific grounding for meaning and purpose in our lives. I mean, essentially looking to science so that we don't fall into nihilism.
Well, you're asking a very important question, which is where does meaning come from? The trouble with science is it takes us back up into the cortex. And I think that where meaning comes from is fostering and bringing positive emotions into consciousness. It isn't science, not science. It's positive feeling versus depression, anger, or just putting the clutch in neutral and obsessing about multiplication tables, which isn't any fun.
George Valiant is a psychoanalyst and research psychiatrist at Harvard University. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Spiritual Evolution.
There's a fish on the hook and a line in the pond, but nothing else is happening here. Well, that old moon in the sky casts light on the ground, and nothing else is happening.
What do you think? Can brain science explain our spiritual experiences? If you'd like to share your thoughts, send us an email to our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Daniel Levitin really does think music makes the world go round, or at least the world of Homo sapiens. It's the case he makes in his book, The World in Six Songs: How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Levitin runs McGill University's Laboratory for Musical Perception, Cognition, and Expertise. He's also a musician and record producer who's worked with Stevie Wonder, David Byrne, and lots of other acclaimed artists. So maybe it's not surprising that Levitin says music has played a starring role in our evolutionary history.
Music helped us with social bonding. It helped us to comfort one another. It allowed for the kinds of social interactions on which societies are based.
So music was, in some senses, a form of communication that preceded words.
I think so. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, this is somewhat speculative, but let's look at some of our closest genetic cousins, the chimpanzees. The way they communicate through panhoots, it's a form of communication where they vary pitch and they vary rhythm. Their utterances are variations that sound to us quite musical. Variations in pitch and rhythm. What's a better definition than that of music?
Right.
To suppose that humans had language before they had music, what you have to imagine then is that Homo sapiens appeared and they forgot what Neanderthals and chimpanzees apparently knew, which was how to make music. They discovered language and then sometime later rediscovered music. That just doesn't seem plausible to me.
You know, we're distinguishing between music and language, although we've discussed music is a language in some ways. Are you making also a distinction between music and sound, noise?
Well, that's an interesting question. One has to be careful here because you don't want to sound like your parents or your grandparents saying, oh, that stuff you listen to is just noise.
I think I'm going to sound like that no matter whether I want to or not.
It seems to me that we want to admit into the circle of discussion anything that somebody regards as music, even if we don't. And it does appear that there are circuits in the brain that process music and separate circuits that process language. speech, sign language, whatever. And then there are some circuits that process both. What this means is that, well, I mean, you can look at Alzheimer's patients. Some of them who lose the ability to remember the names of their spouse or what year it is, their language is impaired, might still be able to sing. This is really evidence that the musical part of the brain may be somewhat distinct from the language part and may have been that way for many tens of thousands of years.
Tell him, Brother Bobby.
I am so happy. Simple pleasures are the best. Hell yeah.
Why do you think it is that music has such power over us?
You know, as a neuroscientist, I would say that we know some of the why it has power in terms of the neurochemistry. It's hitting parts of the brain that are very old. Music has direct and privileged access to parts of the brain that we share with all mammals and indeed with all vertebrates, structures like the cerebellum and the brainstem. All this is a way of saying that music gets in deep into parts of our brain that cause actual chemical reactions. We get releases of dopamine or of prolactin or of oxytocin when we're engaged with music. Now, that's the kind of wet neurochemistry answer. If you were looking for something a little more prosaic, I think it's because music is an emotional means of communication. It's evolved precisely to be that. Language tends to be about very specific things, and it tends to be somewhat constrained. If I say, will you please open the window, there ain't no ambiguity there. Music is non-referential, as the philosophers say. It doesn't refer to anything other than itself and to human emotion.
What about some specifics? At one point in the book, you write about when you dropped out of college to join a rock band, and there was some music that you were listening to then that you said really, I don't know, helped define who you were going to be, really inspired you. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I remember being very inspired by the singer-songwriters of the 70s, people like Neil Young, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, because I felt that they had come upon some new form of communication.
You mentioned Neil Young, for instance, as one of the singer-songwriters of that time. Through My Sails, that was one that you talked about giving you chills.
Yeah, I still get that. It's hard to describe. Of all the songs, you're talking about a prolific and great songwriter. Of all the songs Neil has written, I can't tell you why that one really gets to me. But there's something about not just the song itself, but the performance of it.
Still glaring from the city lights into paradise, I soar, unable to come down for reasons I'd ignore. Total confusion.
Neil is a master at creating a kind of intimate setting where you feel as though they're singing only to you and they're bearing their souls to you and you feel some connection. And boy, the interesting thing for a scientist is to think, well, if this is happening to me, it must be happening to other people. And if it's happening now, it must have happened thousands of years ago. Maybe music has always been a form of naked, open, honest communication. Something you couldn't fake. You couldn't lie your way through it. If you were singing a song and you weren't really feeling it, everybody around the cave and around the campfire would know.
Now, in the book, you've concluded that, as the title says, The World in Six Songs, that there are six basic kinds of songs. And I guess we ought to find out what you think those are.
I think they are the six ways. So it's not that there's six songs that shaped humanity, but I think there's six ways that music has been used by humans to communicate with each other and to form societies. And the six ways are friendship, joy, comfort, knowledge, religion, and love.
I think in order to understand it, we have to have an example. Give me an example of a song that is friendship.
Well, a friendship song might be You've Got a Friend by, as James Taylor sings the song written by Carole King. Or it could be a song like Smokin' in the Boys' Room by Motley Crue, where you've got a bunch of kids who are, you know, outcasts in the school, and yet they have this bond together. They're smoking out, you know, in the back of the school. It's a song of social bonding.
Joy is the next one. Some of those friendship songs are going to be joyous. So how do you distinguish? What's a joyous song?
I don't pretend that a song can only fit into one category. A song can certainly serve more than one purpose. Let's take knowledge songs, for example. We don't have those so much anymore. But before there was writing, before there was, you know, a way to preserve your thoughts on paper or parchment or, you know, in stone tablets, the way that we think humans passed down information was through songs. This is how you build a canoe. When you run out of water, this is where you go to look for it. This is how you prepare this green vegetable so that you don't get sick.
Are there knowledge songs that we're still singing that you think have information that is useful to us?
How did you learn the alphabet when you were a school kid? We have the alphabet song. We have counting songs like One Little, Two Little, Three Little Indians that teach us how to count.
Well, and I think all of us have had experience learning things. It's actually easier if you chant them.
And that gets back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the constraints. The melody and the rhythm provide these constraints so that when you get to the end of the line, it's not just anything that'll fit there. In a well-constructed song, you know, even if you don't remember the word, you don't have that many options about what goes there.
What about religion? You write about religious music. What is it that you think makes a piece of music religious?
I guess I would put something in that category if humans sing or listen to or compose the music as a way of getting in touch with some higher power or putting themselves in that kind of frame of mind. Now, this could be Native Americans as part of some drum circle or, you know, ingesting certain hallucinogenic drugs and singing together. It could be, at another extreme, it could be a mass in a Catholic church. The idea isn't so much that it's about the one God or a particular God. It's about human search, human yearning to explain why we're here and to embrace the idea that there's something larger than just our own existence. And this is a uniquely human propensity. There's no other animal that thinks about their lives and where they're going after they die or who created them. There's no other animal. You know, dolphins and apes, as smart as they are, humans are the only ones that do this.
Do you think that religious music activates a different part of our brains?
There have been studies that show there's a kind of a God center in the brain, and it's activated when people have religious experiences. Now, the interesting thing about this is that both sides, the atheists and the devout, have claimed the God Center as a major discovery supporting their side of the argument.
I think you're going to have to explain that.
Well, so the scientists say there's this God Center, and if you stimulate it electrically or, you know, artificially, we can make you have God thoughts. Or if you have a seizure there, it makes you have a religious experience. And we now have reduced religion to a particular pattern of firing in the brain. Okay, that seems straightforward. But then the religious say, well, God put that in our brains. God wanted us to have a way of communicating with him. And so he designed us and he put that in our brains, and it's activated when he wants to reach us. Who's doing the activating? Who's starting those neurons firing? It's God. I find it fascinating that, you know, the finding was claimed by both sides.
It's Daniel Levitin, author of the book The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Levitin's a professional musician and a research scientist at McGill University.
Why are we here? What's life all about? Is God really real? Or is there some doubt? Well, tonight we're going.
Up next, a philosopher goes looking for the meaning of life. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Owen Flanagan isn't afraid to ask the really big questions. As a leading philosopher of mind, he's investigated what's called the hard problem of consciousness, trying to explain how the neurons in our brains can create our rich inner lives. Now he's written a book called The Really Hard Problem, Meaning in a Material World. Flanagan told Steve Paulson that he is an unabashed atheist. He's also a scholar of religion. In fact, he's talked at length with the Dalai Lama about the connections between Buddhism and science. But what if you don't believe in God, the supernatural, or any kind of non-material reality? How can you find deep meaning in your own life? That's the philosophical problem that Owen Flanagan has set out to explore.
It seems to me, if I look back over the history of not only Western culture, but of civilizations in the East, people from the very beginning of time have been wondering about such questions as, what's it all about? Why am I here? How do I make sense of this? And there are elaborate stories, myths, histories, all kinds of art forms, as well as philosophy and religious literature that address this question. So I think it's the big existential problem that all humans at all times face.
And there's a religious response to this, which is that without God, we're left with no meaning in our lives.
Exactly.
How do you respond to that?
Well, there certainly are religious answers to this question about life's meaning. The ones that we're most familiar with, or that I'm most familiar with in the West, come from the religions of Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And they will tend to suggest that, first of all, God, at the beginning of time, created the universe with a plan. And we achieve that plan by living in accordance with God's law, in particular by living in a moral way. And then we reap the rewards afterwards. The problem with thinking that we need that kind of story, I think, comes from work that I like to do on comparative philosophy and cross-cultural stuff. Now, what's interesting about both the Buddhist and the Confucian tradition is they're not religious in the sense in which we tend to think about religions.
Right. They don't have the God in the Abrahamic sense.
Exactly. So the Buddhists actually are either quietistic or atheistic by our standards. So one question would be, insofar as some people, many people, actually we should say, at many times have invented consoling spiritual stories, it may be a deep-seated human need. But one question we face again and again is, are these stories rational? Do we really need them? And it seems to me the evidence is, from those non-Abrahamic traditions, that many people get away without believing in a god. In Confucianism, you'll read reference to Tian, which is translated as heaven very often, but it's pretty clear that this is an impersonal, the sum of all the things that there are. Many Hindus I know, Hindus of course do have creator gods and lower gods, many Hindus I know all about Brahman and Vishnu and Krishna, but if I ask them, do you believe in them, they say, no, of course not.
Now just to be clear, you are an atheist, you are a hardcore materialist. Why are you so sure there's no transcendent or supernatural reality?
I'm actually not so sure that there's no transcendent reality. What I do think is intellectually responsible is that if a person comes up with a conception of a deity or deities, I want to hear about it. And it's almost always the case that there are stronger reasons not to believe in it than to believe in it. This is related to a comment that Richard Dawkins has made. Everybody is an atheist with respect to most gods that have ever been invented. So, for example, most of us don't believe in Zeus. Most of us don't believe in Krishna and Vishnu. The people who do believe in Krishna and Vishnu and Brahman don't believe in Allah, don't believe in Yahweh, don't believe in God the Father. But here's another argument with that conception of God. If you ask people in the Abrahamic tradition, tell me about your God, they'll say he's the omni-God. He's all good, he's all loving, he's all just, and so on. Then there's a nice argument, which I think theologians take seriously sometimes. It goes like this. If God is all loving, he should want to abolish evil. If God is all powerful, he can abolish evil. But evil exists, both natural evil and human-caused evil. Therefore, God is either not all loving, not all powerful, or none of the above. So that's my tactic, Steve. If someone says to me, you're an atheist, I say, actually, tell me about your God. If it's Zeus, I'll give you some arguments about that. If it's Brahman, I'll give you some arguments about that. If it's the Judeo-Christian God, I'll give you some arguments about that. So you can keep bringing them on. I do like gods, just like Einstein said. If he was a theist, he actually has nice things to say about Buddhism, but he says if he was a theist, he would believe in Spinoza's God, and Spinoza's God famously was God or nature, call it what you will, but God is certainly not personally interested in human affairs, and that's what I think is the best view to have right now.
Now, you've said that the hardest problem that we face is living meaningfully, but it seems like there are some simple responses to this. We all find meaning in our own ways, whether it's through raising our children or doing work that we think makes the world a better place, or by marveling at a sunset or being kind to our friends and neighbors. Are you saying we need something more than our own private construction of meaning?
That's a great question, Steve. Maybe. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Let's put it this way. The examples you gave are things that most everyone would say are genuinely meaningful. It looks like it's a quirky feature of the universe and our kind of social animal that being in loving relations with other people, including a certain amount of altruism and philanthropy outside the family, more often than not makes people feel better than they would think it would.
Okay. That sounds like a fairly reasonable response, hardly a deep philosophical problem then. But it seems like you think it's actually more difficult than that. From a philosophical perspective, there are actually hard questions to wrestle with here.
Actually, I don't always like it when philosophers are supposed to go deeper and deeper and deeper because sometimes there are answers to questions about important things which are staring us in the face. But I guess I would say that, yes, most people pay lip service to the idea that love and friendship are important. Most people, though, in this country are extremely devout and they seem to believe things. I think this would have political implications. For example, people believe such things as that I accomplish what I accomplish because of my chutzpah, my hard work, my conscientious intelligence, and I get to keep what I have. Well, this is a major denial, I think, of other deep points such as luck and life circumstances. A quarter of the people on Earth right now live, according to the World Bank, in a situation of absolute poverty. And rich nations don't do enough for them. We don't do enough for our own people in this country. And it's just luck that puts other people there.
I want to ask a bit about your own background. Weren't you actually raised in a Catholic family?
I was. I was raised in a good old sort of Irish Catholic. After the Second World War, my dad came back. We settled in the suburbs of New York. I, in fact, went to Catholic schools all the way through college, actually. I went to a boys' Catholic high school after elementary school with nuns. And I had a great education at Fordham University in New York.
So when did you lose your faith in God?
I was about six.
So you went through all these Catholic schools, including a Catholic college, and you didn't believe in God during
– It never interfered with my lifestyle or belief. I mean, it's interesting. I did – how shall I say it? I was the oldest of six children. My father – both my parents were wonderful people, but my dad was a hellfire and brimstone sort of Catholic. He had been a – His father had died when he was young. My dad at 17 was a lieutenant in Patton's army. So he was all stick and no carrot. And I understood the Catholic Church to be that way too. And I realized early on that they were down about things like things that sounded fun. and I also was at that time, it's related to the problem of evil. I was very aware of the fact that if God was as I had heard he was, he punished children for bad things and let them burn in hell for all eternity. And I actually started to lapse right then. I thought that a good God would not be like that.
So would you say you have a spiritual life now?
You know, people tell me that on these dating service sites, the most popular answer among educated people when they ask you religious denomination is spiritual but not religious.
And do you fit into that category?
I don't go on those sites. I tend to say that because I certainly think that the method of trying to find meaning in a material world that involves narrow egoism and believing that I am the only thing and I am the only thing that matters – doesn't work for me, but doesn't work for almost anyone.
Do you carry out any practices that I guess we would call spiritual? For instance, do you meditate?
I've been known to meditate. Since my early childhood, I understand as a first-pass aesthetic. When I was a little boy, we did the Latin Mass with incense and things like that. and I was a major altar boy in the ranking of altar boys. So I liked the Latin mass. I liked all the glamour and the smells and things like that. And I still like Buddhist practices. I like actually any kind of religious practices, like being in Indian mud huts. I like being alone on mountaintops. I like sunsets, all the usual things for generating aesthetic experiences. But yes, I have practiced Buddhist meditation.
Well, you also write that sacred music, pieces like Bach's Mass in B minor or Handel's Messiah, can move you in ways that non-sacred music does not.
Exactly.
Which is interesting. I mean, it's interesting to think about that. I mean, it raises the question of whether you are having some kind of religious experience when you listen to those pieces of music.
Right. Well, I certainly would say I'm having, in one sense, transcendental with a small t, spiritual with a small s, unusual with a big U, if you want it, experiences at those points in time. What I would not want to say is that I'm getting in touch with something which is immaterial. That's all I would want to say. I mean, I'm in touch with something which is deep, something I'm really enjoying, something which seems to me to put me in a place where I can be serene or thrilled, depends on the music, and I love it, yes.
Owen Flanagan, talking with Steve Paulson. Flanagan is a philosopher at Duke University. His book is called The Really Hard Problem, Meaning in a Material World. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. How do you find meaning in your life? If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Mind and Meaning, number 921A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.